You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for April 24th, 2015. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside Ted Cruz's State of Nature No-Tell Motel. It's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
What the hell is Ted Cruz talking about?
Well, Ted Cruz talks in apocalyptic language about everything.
That's true.
If he has to wait outside the Senate bathroom to use the little boy's potty, he starts talking about the seventh seal and the end of the world and how this is a sign of the apocalypse. We're all going to... Oh, okay. Yeah, thank you.
The world is on fire. The Lord of the Flies. Lord of the Flies?
And then he gets into the bathroom and no courtesy flush. He's not a kind man. He's not a thoughtful man. He is a lunatic. He really does know his base, though. I mean, really, really, I'll give him that. He knows the batshit people he is talking to and who want to hear, because they don't have Michelle Bachmann anymore. They don't have Sarah Palin to talk about the biblical signs of the end times and how we have to save this great something-something from the evil somebody. Somebody has to step into that role, and Mike Huckabee is, I don't know what he's doing. He's sort of pushed aside by the sheer weight of Carly Fiorina.
Well, and let's just get right into the... I hate to start our podcast this way, but if we don't, we're just going to go down and talk about the clown car. And I don't want our podcast to ever become sort of a list of clown car contents. And let's point at each one and laugh at them, because that just... We could do that every day, every week, for the next 15 months.
First of all,
it'd be a very boring show, and I would be bored by it. So
that's what Hardball is for.
Okay, that is what Hardball is for. Yeah, okay.
Except
Meet the Press. They don't laugh, though.
No, that's the problem. Well, Meet the Press never points at a lunatic and calls them a lunatic. They invite them on and talk about them very soberly, very calmly, and so forth, which is delightful. But
what I wanted to say was I don't want to really start our podcast by talking about the patriarchy, but it does. Sorry, honey. The fact that Ted Cruz is a man.
Yes.
Gives his insanity gravitas with the media that a Michelle Bachmann gets dismissed. It's the same shit, but coming from a man, it's given more gravitas.
Uh-huh. Well, he's also so smart. He's also so very smart, as we're told repeatedly.
He has his Harvard ring on.
That's right.
His Harvard ring around, so yeah. But this Lord of the Flies thing was interesting because apparently at the end of his New Hampshire speech, he talks about the next 20 months are going to be Lord of the Flies. And it was apparently in the context of talking about Iran or ISIS or something in which... in Ted Cruz's world and in Republican discourse is always just conflated as the evil that we must defeat. And this is what they did with Iraq and Al-Qaeda. I mean, George Bush went around giving speeches saying Saddam and Al-Qaeda are out to get us. We've got to do something about that when they had nothing to do with each other. And if you repeat a lie often enough, it just becomes it becomes pudding, and you just take it in.
And this week there was briefly mentioned, I believe it was mentioned on the MSNBC, it might have been mentioned a couple of other places, the fact that ISIS or ISIL or whatever you want to call it might very well be an apocalyptic end time
they're
being run by former members of the Ba'athist regime. They're being run by the people that Dick Cheney fired when he decapitated the Iraqi regime and told to go away, that you're never going to work here again, that you're screwed. This is what happened when they fired the entire Iraqi army.
And Iraqi army's armaments went missing. A lot of guns went missing.
Well, they didn't have enough. They never sent enough troops to guard the ammo dumps.
Right.
The troops left with their guns in hand. And you just told I don't know, 100,000, 200,000 people.
Heads of household. Heads of household. Right.
Exactly. Who have no other means of support, that they will never be able to support their family, and that their trade, which is the military, is no longer necessary. Thank you very much. Take your gun and go home. That day is the day the insurgency began. It began with the people that we were set up. The State Department was ready to go. They were going to reintegrate the army into the country. But from the White House, from the very top, they said, no, no, fire them all. Fire them all. Get rid of them all. We're going to get rid of all those people.
So that's the history lesson. Yeah. But he was talking about Lord of the Flies. I'm getting back to Ted Cruz.
Yeah, yeah.
In the context of this the conflated ISIS and Iran thing. But seeing it as a soundbite out of context, I think everyone on Twitter thought he was talking about the GOP primary race is going to be Lord of the Flies. And so many people on Twitter said, yeah, Ted Cruz is piggy. You know, that's what it is. I do see this clown car exercise as being some sort of really bizarre survivalist science fiction, badly written survivalist science fiction. It's just not something that I want to make the subject of our podcast for the next 12 months. So,
although if we do, every week we could have a sub episode called "Who Has the Conk," which will be about which member of the crazy tribe has the speaking thing.
Well, you know how you figure that out? Who is John McCain yelling at this week?
Yeah.
And this week it was Rand Paul.
Yeah.
You know, being a terrible person for foreign policy.
And Lindsey Graham got in some slaps, too. He was very, very put out. Very, very
well, miffed. John McCain and Lindsey Graham are I vote for a cage match, tag team cage match with John McCain, Lindsey doing, you know, sissy fight nail check from one corner, and then put Rand Paul and Ted Cruz in the other corner and just let them fight it out. Grab the popcorn, because that's just the way.
Two men enter. It'll be Thunderdome. One man leave. Two men enter. One man leave. And bust the deal, face the wheel.
Yeah.
So.
And this is why I think Hillary Clinton needs to do a Rose Garden strategy.
Yeah.
Not from the standpoint of not traveling, but from the standpoint of just staying above it all.
Uh-huh.
And, isn't that interesting? John McCain hates Rand Paul.
It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of weird that from within their party, they can't sort of figure out a foreign policy strategy. I'm kind of amused by that. And she's doing a 50-state strategy, is that right?
Yes. Well, she says she's going to. And that's I can completely understand why. Yeah. Because if the field is swept clean already, there's no point in not. Because the 50-state strategy was always Howard Dean's idea, which the current mayor of Chicago, former chief of staff to Barack Obama, Rahm Emanuel, general douchebag, was head of the Democratic Party. He took over Howard Dean's job.
Douchebag Rahm Emanuel didn't like the 50 states.
Didn't like that. No, and it turned out Howard Dean was right and Rahm Emanuel was wrong, which is not the last time that would ever happen. But the idea behind a 50-state strategy is not to win all 50 states, because you're never going to do that. The idea is to make the Democratic Party competitive in places where it hasn't been competitive for a very long time. Even if you fail, you force your opponent to spend money and time fighting you on a 50-front war, as opposed to giving up on half the states because, well, they're just red, they'll never vote for us. And Hillary Clinton now has enough firepower, enough money, and enough organization to really and truly run a genuine 50-state strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And just as an idea, just as a theory of, you know what? If you're going to win, let's say, California anyway, spend enough to hold California, but really get serious about organizing in Alabama or Georgia, even if you know you're going to lose. But bring the Democratic organization, just like unions should do, into the neighborhoods. Show them, because right now there's no fight in those places. All they ever hear from is Rush Limbaugh. Right. All they ever see is Fox News. There's no competition at all. So conservatives can just make up any shit they want, and nobody ever hears otherwise. And they're preaching to the choir. It is a very good thing to be able to infuse this fight into every level of the country, as long as you have circumstances that allow you to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I think it's really kind of cool that if you cover one eye and just blank out the Republican Party, then and just pretend they're not here. Shh, be very quiet. Let's pretend they're not here. The fight between Barack Obama and Elizabeth Warren is
over the TPP. Yeah.
Over the TPP. The profound disagreements that Barack Obama and Elizabeth Warren have over several issues.
Mm-hmm.
That is the political debate we should be having.
Exactly.
Barack Obama should be the Republican Party. Elizabeth Warren should be the Democratic Party. And the crazy people should just get the fuck out of politics and go away and let the grownups run things.
Yep.
That's what politics looks like in not the bizarro world. Over in the better universe, that's what a fight would look like at the national level. There would be
if everyone was sane.
Yeah.
We would be talking about whether the direction that trade policy should go.
Exactly.
And we have a conversation on it and a decision made based on the facts.
And based on grown-ups talking about the trade-offs, because there's always trade-offs. There's always people who lose.
Yep.
But the idea that we're going to have this super secret trade policy that no one's allowed to see, no one's allowed to debate except by inference, and just take my word for it, it's going to be okay, is absurd. That is absolutely, absolutely ridiculous.
And Obama's wrong about that. He's just wrong.
He is. He's flat out wrong, and he shouldn't do it. And I'm really disappointed. I'm not surprised.
No, I talked about this at the State of the Union because we never talked about it on the podcast.
Huh?
Our 16-year-old came in after the State of the Union and asked us about it because he had all these really big ideas in the State of the Union about universal pre-K. And, you know, it was the mayor of New York speech. It was the Bill de Blasio checklist of things you want to do domestically. And you and I were very proud of 16-year-old really having a sense of these issues. And and he said, but, you know, I don't think any of them will happen. If one of them could happen, do you think what one would you say Barack Obama will get? And you and I looked at each other and said Trans-Pacific Pipeline, and we were just putting our heads in our hands like, oh, we know that's the one he's going to get because it benefits the richest people in the room. And that's, you know, and we were kind of depressed about that. But it was a good question he asked.
Yeah.
The other benefit of a 50-state strategy, I think there's a lot of benefits to it. Giving hope and a sense of belonging to the blue dots in those red states is really important, not just mentally, but in a primary race and in a local election. You can win school board elections. You can win state house elections. This is what the Koch brothers figured out a long time ago.
Yep.
Is you can win state rep elections if you are a friendly, pro-local face and a Democrat. And if if Hillary Clinton inspires those blue dots in the red states to run for office, to go ahead and take the fight to them, that can make a huge difference locally.
Uh-huh. And you're much more likely, we've said this before, you're much more likely to find allies when you're fighting for potholes and stop signs.
Exactly.
Local community.
Exactly.
Because the collective effort, and I'm going to use the C word, the collective effort of everyone working together, which is what we call government, is very clearly and immediately visible at the local level. And it's also very clear when it fails at the local level. When your local government screws up and lets you down or doesn't do what it's supposed to do or blows all its cash at the casino or whatever, you're going to hear about it at the barbershop. You're going to hear about it at the diner. You're going to hear about it right away, and there's no escaping it. So
the Trans-Pacific Pipeline and climate change, people in the barbershop can talk about and understand whether trees are going to be planted between the sidewalk and the street or not.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is an issue that people can actually say, I can tell when that's happened and when it hasn't right away. I know if there's a tree in front of my house or not. I know if my sidewalk is cracked or not. I know if the snow's been removed or not. Those are things that are very concrete, and you can talk to anyone of any political stripe about yes or no, do you want this to happen?
Uh-huh. And you can talk to people at the business level. You can talk to them about bike paths and talk to them about amenities that your town should have and talk to them about traffic patterns, how people can come and go to make the town a better and more prosperous and happy place. And those are things that government controls, local government controls, and you really can build some credibility and win elections on those kinds of issues at the very, very local level. And that's where the Koch brothers started. This is where the fundamentalists and the Republican Party got this right, which was run people for school board, run them for local council, run them for water reclamation district, and build yourself up
It's planting seeds for the future. That's what it is. And Hillary Clinton is planning to be president for 8 years. Uh-huh. And she needs a Democratic Congress.
Yeah, she does.
She's not going to get one if she doesn't start a 50-state strategy now. She's just
nothing.
Not, yeah.
Nothing will happen. Yep. Nothing will happen. It'll be 8 years. It'll be 8 years just like the last four, yep. Let's say. Six is not fair. Can I just mention that Junior Dude and I also had a conversation in the car today about debating.
Oh.
And arguing about issues and talking about issues and how wouldn't it be better to listen? I was being a kind of a jerk in the car. I was talking, those damn Republicans. I wasn't saying that really. But we were listening to radio and I think I was listening to liberal radio.
Okay.
And he says, is that all you listen to, liberal radio? Because I said, no, I listen to everything. I read lots of different papers. Unlike Sarah Palin, I can actually name them if called upon to do so. I do listen to a sampling of conservative talk radio. I listen to neutral radio. I listen to news radio. I listen to local radio whenever possible.
Well, see, this is where you and Junior Dude's biological dad overlap in terms of both having been married to his mom, but also you're both high school debaters.
Yeah.
And so his dad's been talking to him about listening to the other side.
Exactly.
And how you bounce off of that in a debate.
Yes, exactly. And that's right where we went. And I told him this is my personal opinion. You can take it for what it's worth. I'm not speaking ex cathedra. But over the course of many years, I have discovered that there's certain people and certain beliefs that you cannot budge with facts.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't. And it becomes exhausting and a waste of time to continue to pretend as though you can, because you end up wasting a lot of breath and a lot of energy and a lot of time fighting against people who are absolutely dead set, never going to change their mind no matter what you say. And I said, in a debate, there's a judge. And when there's a judge, you have evidence and logic and facts and persuasion. And at the end of the day, somebody says one guy wins, one guy loses. You also have rules. You can't just fucking make stuff up in a debate. You can't lie in a debate. You can, but it comes back to bite you, because then you get your scholarship taken away and your school is punished. We don't have debates anymore. This is what we were going over in the car, which I mentioned on the podcast before. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter that I can walk into the barbershop. I'm using the barbershop as a metaphor. Mm-hmm. With a pile of evidence a mile high, demonstrating to anyone over the age of four that global climate change is a fact and it's caused by people. There are X number of people there who are never, ever going to believe me. It's pointless to engage them and debate with them, because they will not be persuaded by facts. They'll always have a pamphlet or a book or some guy, and they can point you to a website, which is usually Free Republic. And there's nine guys at NASA and an engineer who say that this isn't true. And it's a matter of, they have a deeply inbred, inculcated bigotry, hatred, contempt for people like me, what we believe. They have a certain set of beliefs that they want to be true. And they will only listen to people who tell them what they want to hear. And that's why, frankly, Junior Dude, there are lots of people that you can debate with and have a really robust and interesting argument with, like between Elizabeth Warren and Barack Obama. But there are people, unfortunately, a lot of them are in one political party, who are just absolutely cut off from the rest of the world, and they like it that way. And debating with them as if they were going to change their mind, as if there's a center that we can reach where they will see reason or acknowledge the fact that there are facts out there that are not disputable,
yeah,
is pointless. And that's me, you know, this is me shrugging my shoulders, going, okay, that's why we have to go after the enablers of those people. Those people cannot run the country by themselves. They need enablers in the media. They need enablers in politics, for whom every argument, every time they commit some catastrophe, some atrophy, every time they lie again, there'll always be a David Brooks to slide up and say, yeah, but Democrats are just as bad. Mm-hmm. You know, the liberals are just as bad. That's how they survive. Because if you took away their enablers, they'd perish, because they look ridiculous. But don't let that stop you from engaging those people at the local level over bike paths and street signs.
I was going to say, the owner of the ice cream parlor in your town might be the biggest right-wing asshole you've ever met.
Uh-huh.
But he would love to have a bike path running right by his store.
Absolutely.
That's good business for him, period. And if it's granola and it's bikes and it's natural and it's totally an anathema to his lifestyle, he doesn't care. That's money in his pocket.
No.
So, yeah, you can get what you need and what you want for your community that way. And again, getting back to Hillary Clinton and the 50 state strategy, that's what she can build. Uh-huh. And it wouldn't surprise me if there's a former president community organizer in her corner to help her build that permanent Democratic majority down the road. Speaking of which, I want to talk for a minute about coming across youngest child's copy of 17 magazine, which I know. Oh, my God. All the Manny advice you could possibly want. But she got it from a relative, and I read it when I was 11. Everybody read, you know, it's just like the, we will be talking in Science Fiction University about young adult novels and how everyone's always 2 or 3 years older than you in the book, the hero. Uh-huh. 17 magazine isn't for 17-year-olds. It's for younger than that. But thinking about the millennials and how media communicates with them and what their media reflects back to them, I was amazed by opening up this magazine. There was an article about how to raise awareness and make political change on behalf of dreamers. There was a profile of two sisters, one of whom was born in Nevada. The younger was born in Nevada. The older was born in Mexico and is a dreamer and can't go to college with her sister because she doesn't have papers.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, not having a U.S. birth certificate, she's out of luck. And really making it real that here are these two 16-year-old girls who everyone opening that magazine, you know, right next to the manicure advice and the pimple cream ad, can understand, can identify with these two girls. And not only doing this profile, but giving a sidebar article about how you can help. And you should write to your state representative and ask them for in-state tuition for dreamers.
Wow.
I was just like, oh, my goodness. Yeah. And here's how you find out who your state representative is.
Wow.
And get all your friends to write. And if you send 10 letters, that makes a bigger difference than if you send one. And it just, you know, it goes on and on. It's just real political action. There was also an interview with Laverne Cox, who is the transgender star of Orange is the New Black.
Oh, man.
Talking about individuality and mentioning transgenderhood and mentioning what that is and what it's about and how she was born this way. And then I went to their website and there's an article and a video about a 5-year-old transgendered boy whose parents completely accepted with help of a very informed and supportive pediatrician that this child was born a girl and is actually a boy. And these amazing parents did the whole transition. They changed his name. They cut his hair. They treat him like a son. And you saw this child in this video just blossom into what he wanted to be and what he identified as inside his heart and in his soul. He is a boy.
And it's family. It's family.
And it's family, pro-family. And the mom was just really recognizing, you know, she's every mom. She wants her child to live up to every potential that that child can have.
You know, it is a shame.
And that's on that 17 magazine website.
Let me just, you know what Charlie Pierce's alternate name for Politico is?
It's Tiger Beat on the Hudson, right?
Tiger Beat on the Potomac.
Oh, on the Potomac. I'm sorry.
All I can say is, of course, when 17 magazine is more insightful and thoughtful and future oriented and less racehorsey and douchebaggy than Politico.
Yeah.
Something has gone horribly wrong with their politics.
Yeah.
I mean, I find that story incredibly reassuring.
I do too.
But this is the dichotomy. You know, when you cover up one eye and watch Fox News, and then cover up the other eye and watch Jon Stewart. He's like, so there's this horribly broken machine in the middle of our lives. It's wrecking everything, and the only people who are really able to find their way out from under that machine's influence and try to tinker with it, try to get rid of it, try to rehabilitate it or destroy it, are comedians and teen magazines.
And they're the ones that are allowed to operate outside that Beltway cult. You know, that's
somehow, if I can lightly metaphorize this, this would be This would make a great teen action adventure science fiction novel. All right,
we're getting ahead of ourselves because we have recorded Science Fiction University, but we haven't aired it yet. So keep listening. We have a lot to say about this in Science Fiction University. Driftglass, time for Bible Bitch.
Bible Bitch.
That's not scriptural.
I love Bible Bitch.
Well, thank you. This week's Bible Bitch is from yesterday. I'm reading the Bible in a year. And I do want to do a shout out to the correspondent. One of our listeners wrote us and was quite jarred by hearing the word Band-Aid in a Bible verse because that's such a modern, you know, brand name. And I agreed with this person that the King James Version is the gold standard of biblical quoting.
It's beautiful.
Because it's beautiful poetry. And I would never read on Bible Bitch, for instance, the 23rd Psalm from the Message. I would just read it from the King James Version. So, but sometimes the Message, which is written in modern English, actually hits the right tone in ways that I really like. So more often than not, I'll use the Message, but I certainly appreciate it. And I grew up on the King James Version. I certainly appreciate it. So, but this is from Psalm 49, and it is from the Message by Eugene Peterson. That's his translation. I set plain-spoken wisdom before you. I solve life's riddle with the help of a harp. So why should I fear in bad times, hemmed in by enemy malice, shoved around by bullies, demeaned by the arrogant rich? Really, there's no such thing as self-rescue, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. The cost of rescue is beyond our means, and even then, it doesn't guarantee life forever or insurance against the black hole. Anyone can see that the brightest and best die, wiped out right along with fools and dunces. They leave all their prowess behind and move into their new home, the coffin. The cemetery, their permanent address. And to think they named counties after themselves. This is what happened to those who live for the moment, who only look out for themselves. Death herds them like sheep straight to hell. They disappear down the gullet of the grave. They waste away to nothing. Nothing left but a marker in a cemetery. So there's your happy thought for today.
Man.
But that whole thought about pulling yourself up from your bootstraps, forget it. You know, We have to work for each other. That's the message for today.
That is not the message of the 49th Psalm is not don't do anything. Don't work. don't care. Don't bother. Don't try. Don't make any efforts. No, the message is you really do need a community. Your first highest duty is to make sure that you serve your community, because that's how you survive. I mean, there are no gulches out there. The fantasy that you're going to go into the West, which is not the West anymore, that you're going to create an entire universe just by the strength of your cleft jaw hitting the ground. You're going to chisel out a mountain using your cleft jaw, and you're going to create this libertarian Randite utopia by dint of your own, with no one's help whatsoever, is absurd. It doesn't mean you shouldn't work. It doesn't mean hard work shouldn't be rewarded. It doesn't mean that creative and genius work shouldn't be rewarded highly. It doesn't mean you shouldn't get rich. It means that you operate within the context of your community and your society. And if your wealth and your power and your self-regard comes from pissing on that community, calling it non-existent or irrelevant or unimportant or fuck those people, I've got mine, then your final destination is oblivion. You leave nothing behind but waste and emptiness. And that is inexcusable. Even if you're not a believer, the idea that you're going to use it all up as fast as you can to glorify yourself and comfort yourself and then die and leave nothing but waste behind for everyone else is a profoundly immoral way to live, whether or not you believe in a particular scripture or not.
Well, and David Koch thinks he's going to be remembered for Lincoln Center, you know, and giving money to ballet companies. He's going to be remembered as the poster child for Citizens United and big money in politics, the era in which we live, which will not last forever. It will see the day of its grave, believe me. That he will be that poster child for that era in which billionaires attempted to buy the United States government and attempted to control our society through money. And their day will pass. I caught you, Driftglass, this week.
You did?
Yes. I walked in the living room and you were watching Point Break.
I was.
With Keanu Reeves, dude, in the Surfer Dude movie. And I said, what are you doing? Why are you watching Patrick Swayze, Gary Busey, and Keanu Reeves in this one of the worst movies ever made in my personal opinion.
One of the greatest movies ever made.
1991, Point Break. And you said, you don't understand. This was so funny. You said, you don't understand. Chris Hayes is interviewing Judith Miller. I am switching to Point Break. I would rather watch Point Break than watch MSNBC give a seat at the table to Judith fucking Miller.
And then, as I recall, because it was a long time ago, it was several days ago, I threw myself on the ground, pointed my gun in the sky and went, as I fired my gun, you know, impotently into the air out of frustration of the horror of it all. Or that might have just been Point Break. I'm not sure.
Oh, my gosh. Johnny Utah. Keanu Reeves is Johnny Utah.
Johnny Utah. You mock the movie, but it's got a lot going for it.
Well, it rings more true than anything Judith Miller had to say. I will give you that.
Shoot the hostage. No, that's...
I made a Photoshop of Judith Miller in her pink suit, and there's these flames coming up from her knees. And it was, she's wearing the same pants she was wearing during the Cheney administration. Pants on fire. And I think that there's some shared DNA there between Judith Miller and Carly Fiorina.
Oh, yeah.
In that their institution, they didn't fail their institution. The institution failed them.
It did.
HP, Carly Fiorina did not drive HP into the ground. HP failed Carly Fiorina.
And we should all
be ashamed
of ourselves.
And the New York Times have exactly the same relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it is, and why not?
Yeah.
Why not?
It's amazing to me that they get away with this. It just...
It is, I would like to say amazing to me, but again, I am now on the home stretch of getting rid of my, of going through my blog. You know, the last 10 years worth of stuff. Yeah. And honestly, the metaphor I used last week, I think, was a flip book, like a little cartoon flip book. Mm-hmm. When you flip through 10 years, it stops being amazing.
Yeah.
And it starts being inevitable. Mm-hmm. Because there really is a conspiracy. I don't know what else you'd call it. It's out in the open. It's not like it's a big secret. But there really is a conspiracy to make sure that people like Bill Kristol and David Brooks and Judith Miller and right down the line, Mary Madeline, all the horrible people you see on the Sunday shows are never out of camera range, never unemployed, are never fired. Mm-hmm. There's always a place for them in the constellation. There's always... it is a club. There's always a place for them. And so it doesn't matter how fucking awful Judith Miller is. It doesn't matter how trite and ridiculous her book is. It doesn't matter, because the way all of these people have collaborated to keep themselves collectively employed is by making sure nobody gets blamed for anything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This was the great ideological breakthrough of 2005. It was the great shift between the liberals are always wrong. Holy fuck, they were right about A, B, C, and D. Well, then what do we say now? Everybody's always wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Both sides are always wrong. And that has been absolutely true for the last 10 years. Unbroken string of that. So if no one is responsible for anything, if everyone's responsible for everything, if it's the institutional failure and no person or particular person or individual can ever be held to blame for the crazy shit they said, and the way we avoid doing that is by never mentioning they said that. When David Brooks is cornered and asked about all the terrible things he wrote in his column, he just lies about it. When David Brooks is cornered and asked about his writings on divorce, now that he is getting a divorce, he just lies about it.
Mm-hmm.
And no one's going to hold him accountable. Nobody's going to point to that a week from now and say, hey, David, now that you're on Meet the Press, I've got a question for you. Why the fuck were you lying about everything you've written for the last 20 years? No one's going to say that. It is a true conspiracy of a confederacy of dunces, confederacy of hacks. And Judith Miller fits right in there, because her whole thing is, I wasn't responsible, wasn't my fault, I didn't do anything wrong. I did my job, I'm proud of what I do, I'm a great journalist, and I never admit mistakes. Now, can I point out the weird juxtaposition?
I just I want you to do that. I also want to mention that Chris Hayes' book, Twilight of the Elites, is a lot about this.
It is just
everything from baseball. It just seems to be a generational infection in our culture that no one loses their job. That's just whether you're in baseball or politics or banking or work for Rolling Stone or if you're at that level.
You never
admit wrongdoing, and you just go on because you're protected.
And
I do think it has something to do with being born at a time of the peak of American power, and you are the child of that peak. Where and I've mentioned this before. My girlfriend, who was born in 1946, right at the baby boom, the very beginning, and every single school she went to was a brand new school. From kindergarten on, she went into middle school, brand new school. When she went to high school, brand new school. When she went to college, brand new buildings. Everything was just built for her. Uh-huh. And so then you go out into the work world and you make it to the Manhattan boardroom, you know, with Michael Brzezinski telling you to speak up for yourself.
Speak up. Talk louder.
And ask for more money because you're worth it.
Well,
and it and you can't be fired from that. You're God's special snowflake.
That's right. You're
so,
one of us.
Yeah, you might screw up, but hey, you know, you're protected.
Well,
go ahead. You were going to make a juxtaposition of that.
I would respectfully disagree in one particular. David Brooks is actually my age, slightly younger than I am.
Yeah.
David Brooks, I've been laid off, I think I've said, 5 times in the last 6.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I've had company shot out from under me. I've had all kinds of up and down employment, you know, as millions of other Americans have who are my age.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm old enough and I have enough experience in understanding employment statistics to know how screwed you are in the 2000s if you're above 40 and you're laid off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It means you're kind of doomed. You're never going to earn what you did earn. And you're financially, you're looking at a steep downhill drop for the rest of your life, possibly. So it does depend on when you were born, but it also depends on what club you're a part of. Because just below the surface of those who cannot be fired are those who are fired all the time.
Yeah.
Those who are just laid off en masse. Nobody thinks about it. The people who work for Mitt Romney get whacked all the time. The people who are the worker bees, the people that actually make the country run, the people that actually make things operate, the people that actually teach your kids, the people that actually keep you safe, the people that actually mow your goddamn lawn and cut your hair are laid off all the time for no reason.
And watch that in Scott Walker's case, because that's been pointed out to me by some experts in Scott Walker over at Crooks and Liars, is that Scott Walker just fires people all the time because he can't look bad ever. Yeah. And it's always someone else's fault.
And so above this line, you have, it isn't just privilege. It is the privilege of knowing that no matter how badly you fuck up, your friends will find you another job that's probably even better.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter how badly Bill Kristol fucks up at the New York Times, where he had a job. We'll find him a job at Time Magazine. Fucked up there? Great. We'll get you a job at Fox. Screwed up there? Now you're a permanent employee on ABC News. It is clearly not just a mistake. It's not a bug. The system is set up to conspire to make sure Joe Scarborough has a job forever.
Yeah.
And despite the fact that everyone outside the glass looking inside is pounding on the window going, he's lying, he's a fucking douchebag, here's a bunch of evidence that he's a fucking douchebag and shouldn't be on the air, those people are nobodies. Those people get fired all the time. Those people can die quietly and be shuffled off into the grave and no one will miss them. It is, if you're in the club, you protect each other all the time. And the juxtaposition I was going to make was the David Brooks column this week that I'm not going to dwell on very much was about,
made me laugh so hard,
it was about Marco Rubio. And it was, and I just looked at it. I said, "Oh, it's the John Thune column from 2009."
You told me this morning that you could take the two columns and hold them up to the light, and the John Thune column from 10 years ago,
2009,
and the Marco Rubio column from today would match up.
It's David Brooks has a standard fine young cannibal Republican template where this young man is full of beans and he's was raised right and he's charismatic and he does all the right things. I wrote this, you know, long tongue bath to Marco Rubio this week that everyone will forget except Marco Rubio. the column had nothing to do with me or you or anybody else. It had to do with David Brooks making sure that whoever gets up to the next level knows they owe David Brooks a hand job.
Yep. Yep.
And that's all this column was. It was blowing Marco Rubio.
It was written for one person. And David Brooks does not determine who wins Republican primaries.
Nope,
Rush Limbaugh determines who wins Republican primaries.
Absolutely.
And so David Brooks's relevance, though, is completely within the bubble of the East Coast Republican elites who vote Republican for stability within their class.
Can I take what you just said and make it, let me rephrase it.
Okay.
Rush Limbaugh is in charge of picking who wins the Republican primary.
Mm-hmm.
David Brooks is in charge of making sure the mainstream media never, ever reports on the fact that Rush Limbaugh is in charge of the Republican
Party. Yep, that's his job. Because the bankers cannot handle it.
No.
The Republican elites on the East Coast cannot handle the fact that Rush Limbaugh is in charge of the Republican Party.
So,
because then they'd have to vote, as many of them did, for Barack Obama.
And I wrote a long, long time ago in a post called Reactionary, the Republican Party is a nuclear reactor.
Yeah.
And Rush Limbaugh and the 40 million dolts and bigots and gun nuts and lunatics who vote are the core of the party. They're the thing that provides the heat. David Brooks is there to provide the coolant,
mm-hmm.
to cover up the fact that the heart of the party is horrible and broken and villainous and is being run by terrible people. His job is to make sure that story is never, ever fucking reported. And the way you do that is by bringing everyone into the conspiracy. Yeah. Making everyone, look, I have a way that you can atone for your sins, he tells his colleagues. We all agree that we never call each other on anything.
Mm-hmm.
So that means Mark Shields never reaches across the table and just slaps the shit out of David Brooks. That means that David Gregory, and now Chuck Todd, never asks David Brooks a hard question. When he's on NPR, nobody asks him any hard questions. When he's on PBS, no hard questions. When he goes on college lecture tours, no hard questions. We all agree we're not going to call each other on it. But what that means is we're also not going to ask any hard questions about Bill Kristol.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or Carly Fiorina. Or Judith Miller. Or anybody else who's in the club. And that's what's killing politics, is this silent agreement that I really David Brooks has been the thought leader on, that we're just not going to call each other out because that's uncivil and impolite. And what it really means is I don't want to talk about the Republican Party as it actually exists. I want to talk about the Republican Party as I imagine it should be. And that's
Thank
what keeps
you,
the
Dirk
bank
Lance. We have
My
to,
pleasure, Blue Gal.
We have to stop now.
All right.
Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an Internet Kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's Internet Kitty is Ginger. And I think Ginger may be part Wookiee. She's got that fluffy and furry thing going on at the same time. Very dense fluffiness. And she's just beautiful. Go visit her at our Facebook page and website. You can send your Internet Kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com. This would be a wonderful week to send in an Internet Kitty, believe me. Where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service.
Go Postal Unions!
Letter on the air unless you say otherwise. Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us. We've heard from a few more listeners who finally got their tax refund. Thank you for sharing a bit of that with us. We do appreciate it. We hear you and we understand. Approximately 1% of our listeners support this podcast with a contribution, and you can too. See our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details. Both our PayPal and postal address information is there at professionalleft.blogspot.com. Please rate our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and thank you. So, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Gal, the Internet Kitties are beating the crowds this weekend by enjoying their bootleg Bollywood copy of Age of Ultron.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-dovey. Let's forget about the whine and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with a switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2015, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Jeff Glass.
Science Fiction University comes to us this week once again from the wonderful Dog-Faced Herman.
Bravo.
Dog-Faced Herman says that he was feeding the horses and he realized, I need to get some real work done, do a Science Fiction University.
Yeah, priorities, Dog-Faced Herman. Priorities.
This week, he has sent us 6 clips. Name the movie, the monster, and the metaphor.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
It's going to be kind of interesting.
Okay. All right. Well, I will. I believe that metaphors are like dishes of. I will try. First of all, really great idea. That's a really cool idea. Science fiction, for those of you who don't know, especially shows like The Twilight Zone and Star Trek, were ways to talk about social issues without saying them. You know, you could talk about lynching. You could talk about discrimination. You could talk about racism in ways you could never talk about them on television in the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. If you use science fiction, if you made the aliens Martians instead of African Americans, you could talk about all kinds of things. So science fiction has always been a rich field for talking about social issues. One of my favorites, by the way, if you've never read it, is A Canticle for Leibovitz. The destruction of the earth and the rebuilding of the earth after a dark age with the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a wonderful book, but this is a really cool topic, Dog-Faced Herman. I appreciate it. So let's see how dumb I am.
All right. Number one.
Oh, come on, man. That's the most famous monster in monster history. That's Gojira, also known as Godzilla.
I can't believe you got Gojira.
Oh, yeah. Come on, man. I was raised on Gojira.
Oh, okay.
The smog, you know, and I can't do all the minor monsters. I know Gamera. I know Mechagodzilla. I know a few of them. But when the 30th Godzilla movie came out with him fighting giant worms from Hawaii. Uh-huh. I just lost it. I lost interest in it. But Godzilla is the king of the monsters, the best of all the monsters. I believe this is the original version.
It is, 1954.
His voice hasn't changed.
I mean, that roar is what they use. They just pull that out and use it every time, right?
And this was the one where they cut in Raymond Burr, because you have to re-edit it for the American audience. This was specifically about the atomic bomb.
That's right. That's the metaphor, the atomic bomb.
This was about nuclear war, and this was made right after the American attack on Japan. Not, you know, 2 minutes later, but this was clearly the horrors of atomic war.
All right.
And great movie. Great movie.
Great movie. Now, here's number two.
Uh-huh. Victor, you must help me.
Of course I'll help you.
I'm afraid. I've read this over and over again, but they're just words that I can't understand. Listen, you must have faith in me, Elizabeth. Wait. My work must come first, even before you. At night, the winds howl in the mountains. There is no one here. Prying eyes can't peer into my secret. What can he mean?
Oh, well, I pronounce it Frankenstein, but some purists pronounce it Frankenstein.
He was my boyfriend.
This is based on the original novel by Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley.
That's right.
Who was the wife of Percy Shelley.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote it on a dare.
Yes, she did.
And she is truly one of the great founding parents of science fiction. It's a wonderful novel.
This movie this clip is from the movie version from 1931.
Yeah.
What's the metaphor?
Well, the subtitle, if I remember correctly, the subtitle of Frankenstein was A Modern Prometheus or something like that. Mm-hmm. So this is about tampering with shit you should never tamper with, and taking the power of the gods that you can no longer control. Because it'll always run out of control, because
that's
humans
right.
are not meant to play with certain things.
That's exactly right.
And it was a great movie. And you know what? This is one of those cases where the sequel is actually better.
Mm-hmm.
Bride of Frankenstein was actually a better movie, just technically and in terms of sheer storytelling, than the original Frankenstein. But they were both awesome.
All right. Number three.
We're from MNU. We require your scroll on this eviction notification.
Yes, it's eviction notice.
Put your scroll on the bottom there. You see, there's your name at the top. Christopher Johnson. There's, you're going to put your name at the bottom. You're going to another place, a nice new city built especially for prawns.
Special place.
And we're not even going to charge you, okay? Yeah. Sign the fucking paper.
You don't have a choice in the matter. You just have to sign this document. That's all.
Oh, yeah. This I don't know if you ever saw this. I think I might have been
watching. Yes, you made me watch this.
I made you watch this. Excellent. I don't feel bad. This is District 9, which is an awesome movie from the late 2000s. This is a really recent movie. And it was set in South Africa in a ghetto. So you know what? It's probably about apartheid.
It's probably about apartheid, and it is about apartheid.
And the thing in this one, it made the aliens unattractive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It made them like giant roaches. Yeah.
Gross.
So it was easier to shove them into a ghetto and just rip off their technology if you make them unappealing. The coolest aliens, I forget who said this, that when the aliens show up, they weren't the little green guys. They were 10 feet tall, and they were black, and they were pissed. So.
Of course they were. All right, let's go with number 4.
How are they going to understand us? We're talking sign language. They'll understand us all right. Sure. Sure? Everybody understands when you wave the white flag, you want to be friends? Hey there! Open up! Come on out! We're friends. Hey, that's right. We welcome you. We're friends. Yeah.
Oh, this is one of the great foundational novels of science fiction, and it's been remade like 4 times. This is War of the Worlds.
That's right.
This the original George Pal War of the Worlds with that awesome. The thing about each of these, you'll notice, has a signature sound. Almost all of them have a signature sound. War of the Worlds has that tripod death machine sound. And this is about invasion, about conquest, being conquered by a superior power. You know, suddenly human beings are puny and getting their asses kicked by a bunch of people who don't really care about them, who are perfectly content to wipe them out. So I have to say it's about conquest and domination. Yeah.
And Doc Pace Sherman says imperialism.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's... Picture the Martians as Columbus and the 3 men as Native Americans. Yeah, I can see that. Yep.
Yeah.
All right, number 5.
The power's not off in this area. Could be nuclear.
What are they doing? Why do they come here?
Some kind of instinct, memory of what they used to do. This is an important place in their lives.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. This is one of the million zombie movies that was made. I think it's Dawn of the Dead.
It's Dawn of the Dead. Yes, it is.
Okay. Not Shaun of the Dead, mm-mm, which is an equally awesome movie.
Awesome movie.
The monsters are zombies. I don't know if they have special names or anything like Jimmy or whatever. I think they're zombies. The metaphor is, I guess, zombies are bad.
He says it's consumerism.
And oh, okay.
Also, that nuclear-powered malls scare him more than zombies.
Yeah.
I can see that.
That makes sense.
All right, let's try last one, number 6.
Okay, everyone quiet down. Here we go.
You all right?
But, now
shut up.
Guys, come on.
Minutes after word of a possible earthquake in Lower Manhattan, nearby in New York Harbor, we're getting word of an oil tanker capsizing in the middle of the harbor near the Statue of Liberty. Once again,
that's really close.
There's no way to know
that's
any
really
of this
close,
is connected.
Man. Oh, yeah. This is, they couldn't use Gojira. So they had to invent a Gojira that wasn't Gojira. And it's Cloverfield, which is very clever technically. It suffers as a movie, I think, from some serious flaws. But technically, it is the Blair Witch Project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the idea of it's an unbroken cut. It's an unbroken take from start to finish.
Of a video of somebody making a home movie of a birthday party, I think, right? Or some sort of party, and then
there's a
party comes in.
And then, well, they don't know what it is, but things start falling apart. The Statue of Liberty is destroyed. The city is under attack. And they find clever ways of reporting the story. You know, they can see it from a distance. They have no idea what's going on. And they run past, I think, like an appliance shop. And shoot through the window the TV report of what's going on. Mm-hmm. So they find all these clever... And setting the whole thing up must have been really intricate and fun and maddening.
Yeah.
I don't know what the metaphor is.
9/11 is what...
Oh, okay.
Because it's New York City under attack.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'll buy that.
And this is from 2008. So, that's interesting. Well, thank you, Dogfaced Herman. Before we go, I'd like to talk a little bit about... We went to Middle Child's Book Fair.
Yeah. Well, literary fair.
It was the literature fair where middle school students, sixth graders, had to present their independent reading project, a work of fiction that they had read. It was a it had to be a novel. I think it had to be 215 pages or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had to put together one of those big trifold cardboard presentation boards about their book, and you walked around their classroom and met with each student and talked to them about their book. Why don't you tell them about what your response was to all of the different books that were out there?
Well, first of all, my response was, holy crap, how come my school couldn't have been like this?
I know. I know.
You know, boy is middle child in the right place.
Yeah. Well, and let's be clear. This is a school that is in the district. It's a gifted magnet school. Springfield, Illinois has done it right in terms of magnet and charter schools, in terms of not getting too creative and making these separate schools solve a problem for the mayor or governor.
Right.
They simply are part of the district. The teachers are union. The teachers are part of the district. Yep. And it's not, there's nothing creative done as to poop on anybody, you know.
Keep the wrong people out.
Right. No, it's not that. And there are problems with gifted magnet schools when you start judging schools based on test scores because you've sucked out the top 10%.
Yeah.
And exactly. Put them someplace special. This middle school is specifically designed for weirdo geeks.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
We saw so many spectrum kids at this lit fair who couldn't make eye contact, only wanted to talk about, science fiction.
This is the entire future cast of the next generation of the Big Bang Theory.
It all is. In one room. Yep, all in one room.
And I love them all. I mean, these are
amazing kids. This is
my tribe. These are the people I chaperoned on a field trip a little while ago and had a wonderful time. They're proudly nerdy and proudly smart, and they're all, from every walk of life you could imagine. And the key factor is the thing the school really demands is parental involvement.
Parental involvement for these schools that are schools of choice, as they call them. Yeah.
If you choose to send your kid there, and
you
got to
be there. Yeah.
You got to be
part of the education process. Yeah.
And they are. And everybody from very, very well-to-do families from the
doctor's kids. You see a lot of the doctor kids. Huh? Yep.
Just single moms and single dads.
Moms whose kids are very bright and deserve to be around kids who will not bully them. And that really is part of it. Yeah.
But the literature
is why we're bringing this up in Science
Lord.
Fiction University.
Well,
it was a theme.
Once upon a time, because all good stories should begin once upon a time, I started telling stories to my stepkids, the daughters, my daughters, stepdaughters. And they wanted me to make stories up. So we started making up stories. I started making up a line of stories. And I stole from everybody. But my beautiful and charming wife has been needling me to write a children's book or write a series of children's books. Not children or young adult
fiction.
Books, which I think sounds suspiciously like work. And
I'll help you. The stories that you've been telling, that you told the girls when they were younger, as you say, they're all based on science fiction short stories and stuff that you already know is there. And what I was thinking was you do a young adult fiction that is also annotated for adults in terms of, okay, this element of the story comes from, and you put end notes that say, here's the story this comes from. So you aren't plagiarizing, you know, you're actually saying, I'm doing the history of 1950s, 1960s science fiction within the framework of a young adult novel.
Yeah.
And that would be the hook. Oh, and by the way, six young adult novels. You don't sell one book. You have to sell a series. Yeah.
And there would be no plagiarism involved, but I do borrow like Robert Heinlein liked Cats and Bicycles and Mars. So, you know, and so forth. That sort of thing. So like I said, it sounds a lot like work, but it sounds like fun work. And so I'm toying with the idea. I think it's a very fine idea. At least as long as I have some spare time, might as well give it a shot. But this really was free market research for me. It absolutely was, because it was so clear that the tween lit market is extraordinarily well defined. It's like a haiku. It has rules. It has really clear rules you got to follow. And within those rules, you can be as creative or derivative as you like. But it was, I just started asking right at the first booth, and there were a whole bunch of booths around there. There were probably 20 in the room. Mm-hmm. But it was, did you enjoy the book first? What's the age of the protagonist? What's the plot? Who's the villain? About how old do you think the protagonist is? And
it's always 2 years older than I am, which is what you always want, right?
Exactly. And is there is this the only book, or does this author have other books? Like, is it part of a series, or is it similar to authors' other books? And with one notable exception, which is an author who wrote mostly sports novels, mm-hmm. and wrote one science fiction novel outside of, but he's already really well known, so he doesn't have to sort of follow those rules. Every single friggin' one was a young teen in a dystopian future or a dystopian fantasy future where either the 1% are trying to kill them, they're trying to wipe them out, or some upper class group,
mm-hmm.
might be aliens, might be rich people, whatever, is trying to destroy them. And within that group, there are specially gifted people. Most of the gifted people have sided with the 1% because that's what happens in a technocracy. But one small band of ragged outsiders, led by our teen hero,
has gone underground.
Has gone underground and is fighting the power and is going to overthrow them. And it's awesome how completely uniform, mm-hmm. the rules are. This is like writing Pulp Fiction in the 50s.
It is.
I mean,
it
you can
is.
Write anything you want, but here's what you're going to write about. And here's what you can't write about. Can't show penises. Can't talk about sex. A lot of things you couldn't do in the 50s that once those rules were opened up.
The overplot is so similar that you now know what to do. You know the framework in which, in order to sell it to an agent, which is what you have to do.
Exactly.
It will have to fit in this box, and it will have to be 6 books. I mean, that's just...
Minimum 3, maximum 6. And if you sell one, you'd better have two on the back burner.
In the bag. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So
and not just this is not a slight on the quality of those books.
I think some of them were amazingly well written from what the kids talked about, really.
And they were engaged. They were reading that. This was like the second or third book they'd read because they liked reading. This is the Harry Potter thing. You know, it's not the first time a child wizard and warlocks and dragons and other. No, it's the same grab bag of fantasy / science fiction metaphors that everybody uses.
Right.
But it's the quality of the writing. Some of the writing was pretty, I would imagine, pretty terrible. Some of it was clearly focused on young men.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them on young men with sports interests.
You think because a child is gifted that they're just going to automatically gravitate toward wanting to read. Some gifted kids have a really hard time sitting still in front of a printed page for a long time. And so you really need it to be about sports, or you need it to be about computer games, or you need it to just to get the kid. I mean, reluctant readers come in all levels of intelligence. So
and it has to.
You
it has to
grab
move.
Them. Yeah.
It has to move from page 1 to page 252, mm-hmm. which is what it has to be. It has to move along fast. Yeah. They should have evil relatives who are trying to destroy them, close friends who betray them, possibly a sister or stepsister.
Maybe even the love triangle. One of them had a love triangle. Yeah. So.
And always, this person has to be a secretly gifted individual, either a prince or a divergent, or an insurgent, mm-hmm. or a lactose intolerant, or something that makes them special and super. And they're not aware of it until this is revealed. This is also Percy Jackson, I think.
Yeah. It's got to be revealed to them that they have some sort of gift. Right. Amazing.
And it turns out that the stories I was telling the girls, which have been sitting on a shelf in my mind for a couple of years now, can be made into this.
Quite easily.
Can be repurposed into this genre, which I would be glad to do for money. never stint on the quality, because every great book I enjoyed as a kid, Edgar Eager, I liked him a lot. All the stuff I loved as a kid, those writers didn't do it for free.
Right.
They were paid. Now, Dr. Seuss got paid. Seuss got to get paid for this,
Right.
But they didn't ever, they never neglected their audience. They never looked down on their audience. They never treated the people they were writing for as, oh, Jesus, I got to write another one of these for rugrats. No, they always respected. That's the thing. Every one of these books really deeply respects the reader and deeply respects the fact that they want them to keep reading their books.
Right.
And is approved by the teachers. This is stuff that, you know, this is pass through the school system and is assigned as a way of thinking through plots and characters and all those things.
And right. And these presentations were quite detailed in terms of number of steps. They really did have to know about the overplot and then the character development and so forth and learn how to read a book and analyze it from what they were doing.
Yeah. They had to write diary entries in the voice of a character. A great deal of detail, and they could feel these questions. These are not books the kids skimmed. They read them deeply, and they read them for pleasure, and they thought about them a lot, and they presented. So I'm like, yeah, so thank God for this school. Thank God for this program, because I would have had to spend months doing market research on these things, and now I can just sort of know, thanks to all these young men and women who gave it up for free.
Great. Yep. All right. Well, thank you again, Dogface Herman, and we'll see you next week with another Science Fiction University.
Yay. Thanks, Dogface Herman. Bye-bye.
And I love you.
I love you, too.
People will write to us and wonder if we're fighting, if I don't say I love you at the end of the show.
Yeah, you say that.
We never fight.
We do. We fight occasionally.
No, I get upset about something outside of our relationship, and then I hold it in until you ask me, and then it's like we're fighting.
Look, Rand Paul is highly underestimated and has some very important issues that he wants to share with the American people.
Oh, quiet.